Topic of our Dhamma talk this evening is mindfulness in daily practice. The retreat is coming to a close, and sooner or later all of us will have to move on. Most of you will be going home, and the question arises how take this or what to do with this practice while at home. Now, in dealing with this topic, we shall discuss some very basic aspects about mindfulness in daily life, and those very fundamental aspects I will kind of run through a little bit faster. Some of you will have heard this advice already, and then we shall look at some additional aspects connected with the daily life. And for one thing, Jim has asked a question as related by Marcia: how to, as a lay person, how to live a spiritual life in community. Is that correct, Jim?
Sure.
Yes, so we shall explore that question, and there are many aspects connected to that, and we will do that in a somewhat more open format. So if you have some additional questions or pointers, then please feel free to add. And I brought my pen along, and I will also write down a few things. And then part of this is how to relate with one's old friends. Do they really remain one's old friends, or do we need some new friends? And and then Chris has suggested that we might meeting with old friends, and the development, our development, and their development may have been somewhat different or divergent. We might meet in a common ground, such as old age, disease, and death. And so wait and see. Don't laugh too soon. And Alan has certainly made an important contribution. He has certainly recommended that I include a few words about clear comprehension, and in particular, comprehension of purpose or benefit. Is that correct, Alan? He's correct. Okay, so. Now, all of you have, or we've been meditating together here for about a month, and you have all had some fabulous development in your meditation practice. The other day, the talk was about wisdom part two, and then the insights, and in particular, the benefits to be gained by the meditators. So with this, especially with the practice, you will have gained a first taste, or maybe more than just a first taste of the Dhamma, but maybe a taste of some new aspects of the meditation practice. And so then the question arises, what next? How to proceed with one's meditation in the future? Now, in this certain context, when we go back, then please, one thing, please don't do. Don't take your Dhamma practice and lock it up in the storage room here of the San Geronimo Lodge. The lodge will not accept any Dhamma luggage. So the Dhamma is here to be taken back into your daily life. Take it with you. Don't leave it here. And if you were to leave it here, then Marcia and I, and Chris and Alan and Surya will be greatly disappointed. Now, The main advice for your daily life is simply the maxim as before, namely, whatever predominant object comes up in your daily life, label it and then observe it and try to know its nature, and be this a physical object or mental object. Obviously, you won't be able to be mindful in this way of each and every object. That would go a little bit too far. Obviously, there are certain limitations. And so, let's say if you work in a very busy company, a company that has a huge amount of orders, and those orders need to be honored, so then there's much work there, and so you have to rush while you're on the job, and then you have to be mindful while you are doing your work. Doing things a little bit faster. Also, as another restriction, here during intensive practice, we can develop the labeling to a great level or degree of perfection, but during daily life, especially at work or in other places, this might not necessarily always be so easy. And let's say if you're talking to your boss, or your boss is talking to you, and he wants to have an answer to a really important question, and you say, "Sorry, sir, I haven't finished being mindful of the latest activity," then you might get kicked out right away. So that will not work. I know. There's further things to keep in mind. Within 1 month of intensive practice, what do you think? Your mind has become much coarser, or your mind has become much more refined? Refined. And refined to a degree that you might not notice anymore, but that becomes obvious when you go back into the world. And so a major mistake would be if right after the retreat you would say, "Okay, enough of this mindfulness practice, now it's time to have fun, and I will hit the casinos in Las Vegas." And so if you were to do this, that would be a great pity, because then probably within just a night or two, you would spoil all the hard work that you've done here within a month. So there's certain places that might not necessarily be that proper to go to right after a retreat. So in terms of a transition from intensive practice to daily practice, please try to be as gentle with yourself as possible, and try to schedule some silent time, some time for practice. So obviously you will have to communicate, you have to interact with your family, with your friends, but you also want to set aside some time for formal sitting meditation, maybe even formal walking meditation, and just you may want to spend some time in silence. So if you do this over a couple of days, then it might it will surely help you to make a smooth transition. sometimes, or you know, the idea of immediately after an intensive retreat to go right back to the workplace might not be such a great idea. And people have done this in the past and have found that this is not really suitable. Now, in the long run, it certainly would make a lot of sense to schedule periods of intensive practice with periods of mindfulness in daily life at home or wherever one happens to be. So, with the end of a retreat, or the end of a retreat, does not mean the end of your mindfulness practice. But rather, you take the mindfulness practice with you and you try to integrate it into your daily life as much as possible. And the details of this will be explained in a short while. Now, if we found a liking to this certain form of insight meditation, then indeed it should stay with us for as many years as possible, and ideally for the entire life. Now, during intensive practice, much may happen in our meditation. The development in the practice usually tends to be quick and steep. So in a limited period of time, we manage to boost our practice tremendously and reach heights that previously, or that during daily practice, we won't be able to achieve that easily. However, during daily practice, the development will be overall somewhat slower and a little bit less steep. However, if you keep up your daily practice and you practice every day without fail, not just for a week, not just for 2 weeks, but for, let's say, several months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, etc., then the results are not likely to be there. So continuous and steady daily practice over a longer period of time may make a huge difference. And a Burmese couple in the UK, in Britain, both of them are medical doctors. Both of them have very little time because both of them have their own individual practice, medical practice, and they've had a hard time finding a replacement. A replacement is expensive, and they had a hard time going for regular longer retreats. And so they knew that their only chance to really deepen in the Dhamma was to focus, or to be totally focused on their daily practice. And this is what they did. And so over a period of 10 years, they had a substantial progress. And true event I'm just sharing with you as to serve as an inspiration. Now, what else can we do to sustain our involvement with the Dhamma? So first of all, obviously there's the practice itself. And then there would be reading of occasional reading of Dhamma books, or listening to Dhamma tapes, or downloading Dhamma talks from the internet and listening to those, or or spending time with like-minded people, occasionally attending a group sitting, and then on occasion, if certain conditions permit, then maybe to schedule a self-retreat at home. So the way this works is, some meditators have been doing this quite successfully. So on Friday afternoon after work, the first trip would be to the department store, then to stock up on. Yes, Kim?
Food.
On food, there you go. Yeah, and then to do all the cooking Friday evening. And then to unplug the telephone, switch off the mobile or the cell phone, and then to start practicing. So then Friday, Friday evening, all of Saturday, and Sunday might be available for a short weekend retreat. And some meditators have done this in a pretty well-determined manner, and they've benefited from it. And now, just a few moments ago, I mentioned group sittings. If in your town or in your neighborhood there is no Vipassana group, then you might consider starting one. And just to announce it, and get some of your friends to come, friends and certain people who are interested to come and attend. And that usually is a way of very much stimulating interest in the Dhamma. Now, another important way of supporting our meditation practice and our spiritual life is by maintaining the five precepts. So the five precepts of not taking life, of not taking what is not given, of refraining from unlawful sexual relations, which means adultery plus sexual abuse, and then to refrain from wrongful speech, and then from refraining from taking intoxicating substances. So as mentioned already at the outset of the retreat, being well established in Sila is a wonderful way to ensure that concentration can arise, and based on concentration, then intuitive wisdom can further develop. Now, sometimes certain meditators come and say, well, I have about 2 hours to spare every day. How should I divide my time? Should I do, let's say, 2 hours non-stop vipassana, or should I do 1 hour in the morning, 1 hour in the evening, etc., etc.? So my personal recommendation for this is to maybe schedule 1 hour of loving kindness meditation in the morning, so metta bhavana, and which will very much help to tune the mind in a very positive way, to ensure that there is a positive attitude towards oneself and all the people around one, and then in the afternoon or in the evening, whenever an opportunity comes up, to do 1 hour of insight meditation. Or you can also divide your time differently. That's up to you. And yes?
So, for the metta meditation, do you have a recommendation for categories?
You could start you start with yourself, and then with your parents, teachers, and friends, and just like that, or you go by way of location as you like. There's different possibilities there. So it's either by groups of people, usually from the closest, starting with the closest people, and or those to one to whom one is closest, and then extending one's metta to people who are maybe not that close. Yes, Long.
Instead, can we make we do the 15 minutes of metta, and then the rest will be vipassana for each session of the sitting?
You would like, how long would you sit all together?
1 hour in the morning, 1 hour in, at night. So the first 15 minutes are usually
15.
15 minutes are usually do the metta, and 45 minutes left for vipassana.
Well, that's fine too. Yeah, that's fine too. Sure. I know. Now see, during our daily practice at home, we have much more flexibility. And so, then, or during an intensive retreat, usually it's recommended not to mix practices. But with your daily practice at home, then there's certain, a little bit of mixing, doesn't hurt that much.
You just extend
the period per per group of people. No, so rather than doing, rather than spending maybe 2 minutes on let's say your parents, you spend 3 or 4 minutes on your parents and then family and so on. And now, in this connection, if you have the time, if you have some extra time to do walking, formal walking meditation, go ahead and do this. If not, then you could consider being mindful while walking down the street and certain things like this. And then as another important point, I highly recommend that after your sitting, you write down your experiences, because this will force you to observe properly. Otherwise, it may easily happen that you sit in meditation and let's say you're pretty tired from work, and then you just spend the entire sitting just nodding. And then there's not much meaning to it. Now, in the connection with the daily practice, it's also very important to do one's formal meditation, especially when one doesn't feel like it. So when you feel, let's say, rather irritated, full of anger, maybe even rage, that's the time to hit the cushion and to look at those difficult mental states. And in the end, you can congratulate yourself because then you have an opportunity to learn about anger and rage. If you would meditate only on the days when you feel good, so-called sunshine meditation, then how are you ever going to experience the unwholesome mental states? I know. So don't exclude those. Consider those as your friends. And also, if you feel pretty tired, nonetheless, try to give yourself a push and then work with the tiredness as best as you can. And over time, that might help you to deal with it. And remember, here during this retreat, the last hour of the day, the last sitting during the first few days, well, most everyone was nodding once in a while, and now there, I suppose, there's less of this. Is this correct? So it's just, you work with the tiredness, and then gradually one gets a handle on it. Now, let me see what else. Now, furthermore, mindfulness in daily life doesn't mean, or is not limited to only your formal sitting practice, so the hour in the morning and the hour in the evening or afternoon, but rather mindfulness should be integrated into one's entire day as much as possible. Obviously, there are certain situations where it's not that easy, but at least one should try to make an effort. And so there are certain simple activities like opening and closing doors. You could, I think Jack Kornfield has recommended this in one of his certain books, one could proceed as follows, namely one day one determines, okay, I will be in particular mindful of every time I open and close a door. So the emphasis then is on that, opening and closing the doors, or getting into the car, getting out of the car, or whenever you put on your shoes, or whenever you take off your shoes, or maybe at least once a day when you take a meal, and so on. So certain creativity it could be quite helpful in this regard. Also, when you talk to others, you might want to do this with some amount of mindfulness. Obviously, not as much as you can muster during a retreat. And certainly, if you're aware of what you're intending to say, if you're aware of the tone of your voice and maybe the movements of your lips, etc., then that's already pretty good. And also, another possibility would be every time you make a phone call or you receive a call, you could do that with some degree of mindfulness. Yes, Sharmila?
Before I make a suggestion, because I've struggled with this issue for a long, long time, and I finally hit what worked for me, to use up all those hours when you're interacting with people and doing things in a way to be mindful then. It's in a book called Dancing with Life by Philip Moffat. He's a spirit rock teacher, and it's basically about, it's the Four Noble Truths as a 12-path practice, three paths to each truth, about understanding dukkha and then releasing craving. But it's an insight practice that integrates, in my experience, very well with this practice. And so it's like you practice feeling dukkha during the day. And the book is written for lay practitioners to be used in daily life.
So very good.
Very practical instruction. And that really, for me, made a huge difference in being able to actually practice during the whole day and see, I noticed anger and stuff. And the training I got from that in like releasing clinging helped me on the insight intensive meditation practice here, because when it came up intensely, I was better able to release it because I've been doing practice in daily life specifically for 2 years now. I recommend it.
Very good. So this is Dancing
With Life.
With Life by Philip Moffat.
Moffat,
okay. And maybe to add along this life, in Lubini I've made it a practice when talking to people, and especially let's say to some stranger, some newcomer, and you never know what the person is like. And obviously then the body reacts in different ways, and sometimes there will be maybe a pleasant feeling in the body or an unpleasant feeling, and simply to be aware of this. And if certain anxiety is there, okay, just to be aware of this. And that then very much helps if one feels certain insecure or anxious or maybe even afraid of another person or of a particular conversation, then being mindful of this while the conversation is going on really helps to let go. And it certainly then very much helps to be much more authentic with people and much more relaxed. And okay, so there is certainly that. Now, in general life, Obviously, you won't be able to label as much as you're doing on retreat. That's fine. And certainly also, you won't be able to do all your activities in daily life with the slowness that you're doing things here. And if you were to do so at the workplace or so, this might get misunderstood. Just a short story in this regard. A few years back in Europe, during one of the retreats, I think it was in Belgium, there was a meditator from Switzerland, an elderly man, married man. And so towards the end of the retreat, we discussed mindfulness in daily life, and he said he liked the Vipassana practice so much that when he got back home, or back to his home and his family, he continued to practice slow walking meditation, thinking that this would contribute to peace and harmony in his family. And what do you think happened? His family got really irritated with him, and they just couldn't stand him walking around at snail's pace. And so he had to make some adjustments there. So you do have to, with your mindfulness practice, not everyone understands what we're doing here. And so you'll have to see, you have to adjust according to time and conditions. Now, also along the same line, if you've had a wonderful retreat, you've had all these wonderful experiences, and you're really gung-ho to continue with your practice, well, and then you get back home, you meet with your family, you meet with your friends, and then you start proselytizing. You have to book into the next mountain hermitage retreat. It's coming up when? You don't know. What's that, November? So, if you do like this, you might lose some of your friends. They might not like it too much. So you have to see how much they can take. If a person is showing some genuine interest, then go ahead and explain. But if there's no genuine interest, then better don't explain. And then just be as mindful as you can, and try to live with wholesome qualities. And sooner or later, people will notice, oh, this person is so positive now. What's happening? And then they start asking questions, and then they might show some interest. And so things do take time. So in general, we can say, if you're during daily life, if you're mindful of what you're doing, of what you're saying, of your predominant thoughts and predominant mental states, then this is good enough. And if on occasion some really strong mental states, negative mental states come up, like restlessness or anger or sense desire or whatever, then by all means don't act on those. That would be the greatest mistake. And one could say from on an experiential level, from from experience, any decision taken based on unwholesome mental states raging in the mind will be a poor decision, and you will probably regret that decision. And don't take any quick decision. Don't react based on negative, strong negative mental states. And rather not say anything and just go away and do something else. And then let things sit. Let your mind settle. Let it become calm. And then with a calm and clear mind, think it over. Think over the situation, and then probably you will come up with a proper solution or proper way of handling the situation. Now, after maybe along the line of what to do when you meet your family, what to do at that point. Well, don't expect them don't expect them to understand where you're coming from, and so they may still relate to you in ways that they related to you before you went to the retreat. So they might relate to you in their ordinary, rough manner. And so here you come off the retreat, your mind is extremely purified and refined, and then someone yells at you. You might not find that too pleasing. And so be prepared for this, and then don't take things too personally. Also, I've read a nice remark in one of in one Dhamma book, but I forgot the exact title and the author, either Jack Kornfield or Joseph Goldstein. And I think it was once a meditator had remarked after a retreat, it was like partially, at least, like putting on the old clothes in terms of, well, now the old habits are coming back and certain old mental patterns are establishing themselves. So ideally, we don't want to put in put on old clothes, but rather we want to wear our new suit of mental purification. Now, mindfulness in daily life might certainly be useful in many different ways. It's for one thing, the Buddha recommends if we're sick, then it's high time to apply mindfulness, since this will help to deal better with the difficult physical formations, pains, and And so if one were not mindful, then most likely the mind would react strongly towards pains and aches, and then maybe aversion would arise, or some sadness would arise, etc. And with this one would suffer, there would be a twofold form of suffering. Now, mindfulness sadhana practice may also be very helpful for those of you who raise sadhana children. So if you can introduce them at an early point, they will surely benefit sadhana from this. And there are a few people who are looking into this, and there might by now already be some literature around. And yes, Marcia?
Yearly retreat at the Insight Meditation Society, and also one at Spirit Rock, family retreat.
Uh-huh.
People can bring their children.
Yes.
I taught it at IMS for a number of years. It's been going on for many years. I don't teach it anymore. Somebody else does. But it's a wonderful 5 days for families and children. And there's activities, there's meditation, both for the adults and for the children, groups. It's well worth looking into if you have children.
Yeah.
And the Spirit Rock also has...
young adults. And I think the Tathagata Meditation Center in San Jose, California is also now, or has been offering a similar program for many years. The kids had to stay at sleep at home, and then the program was only during the day at the monastery. And if I'm not mistaken, now they even have the kids sleep in the monastery.
I mentioned the one at Spirac is for the whole family.
Or for the entire family,
even. The whole family. Yeah. Oh. It's really
wonderful. Well, children up until the age of 14.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the teen retreat is from 14 and 19, and then it's for 5 days, and then the teen sleep and then spend time.
Yeah, the older children come, or the teenagers, young adults, they like
they
to be called.
They said that teen retreat.
They like it very much, and you know the kids like it, and so the experience.
The children love the one with their parents. I mean, it's really a wonderful retreat.
And the experience from Burma is probably the same thing here in the U.S., that it's not just the kids who like it, but the parents also like it very much, not just because the parents are actively involved, but the parents get certain children back who are much more much better behaved afterwards.
For the teenagers, it's like a community of like-minded people. Like you go to a vacation spot, they take care of you, your meal and your board and your spiritual, and it's like with a group of like-minded people. Last time I was there, it was 37 families that just come from all walk of life, and it was amazing. Yeah. So we are on...
That was at Spirit Rock.
No, that was at IMS.
IMS.
Uh-huh. Somebody asked, I just answered it.
Yeah, sorry.
How old... it's interesting. I don't know now, but when I was teaching it, if a family had a child that was above three, I think
they started
two maybe. But if you had a baby, you could come if you were willing to take care of your baby yourself. Oh. You can't pass the baby to the children. But 2-year-olds, there is a group from 2 to 3, and then on up to 14.
It's a wonderful way of introducing Buddhism to the children. And because they have their friends, and then they do like all the rhythm, like the bowing, and all by, on their own, they do the offering of the flowers. Wonderful.
And the latest thing at IMS is, I heard about this last year. Last year, a monk from the Achan Cha tradition from Canada, he started a stupa construction project. So the kids all together, he got them engaged in building a small stupa. And every year, the course adds one layer, and then they put their names there and put various other things in there. So that
they have a pottery wheel, and so they make little statues, Buddha statues, and at the end of the retreat, each of them walk with the light and the statue, and they walk all the way to the stupa, and they put it down there, and then the monk did the blessings, and they did skits of Buddha's legends, and it's wonderful.
Right. So there's that. Let me see. Now, one word of caution is mindfulness in connection with driving. So if your practice is really, really good, really outstanding, then you want to be very careful with your with driving. And there are certain points in the practice when it's better maybe not to be too mindful or not to be too concentrated in one's meditation, and rather pull over to the side and then let the states pass and then continue to drive. Okay, so now there's that, and when, especially when driving, your main focus needs to be on what's happening on the road, and maybe less so what's going on in your mind and in the body. And otherwise, it might lead to some serious consequence. Now, Alan, has Sutna suggested to include the point on clear comprehension in daily life, and Sutna, this is a good point, well taken, namely, before we do something, or before we say something, or even think in a certain way, then we might suddenly consider whether what we plan to do or say or think is really beneficial or not, whether there is a purpose to this, whether it is purposeful or not. And certain clear comprehension is certainly defined in the Pali language as sampajanakari hoti, which means acting in a clearly conscious manner. So one is conscious of, fully conscious of what one is certainly doing or saying or thinking. Now, the context in which one of the contexts in which, or for which the Buddha had certainly recommended clear comprehension is certainly that is as follows, and I'll be quoting from the Digha Nikaya, volume 1, paragraph 70. And how is a person accomplished in mindfulness and clear comprehension? Here, one acts with clear comprehension in going forth and back, in looking ahead or behind, in bending and stretching, in wearing one's certain clothes, and suddenly then in eating, drinking, chewing, swallowing, in evacuating and urinating, in walking, standing, sitting, lying down, in waking, in speaking, and in keeping silent, one acts with clear comprehension. So, in other words, clear comprehension is an initial form of wisdom, and one is certainly clearly conscious of what one is certainly going to do or say or think. And this certainly clear comprehension has different meanings depending on the context. The commentary speaks of four kinds of clear comprehension, and the first one is certainly clear is sataka sampajanya in the Pali scriptural language, which means clear comprehension of purpose or benefit. And so it means you check for yourself in particular whether an activity planned is really going to contribute to my overall development of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, and or not, and then also maybe in terms of effort, in terms of faith, and then what I'm planning to do, say, or think, is this going to be beneficial in terms of sila, in terms of the virtues? So, will it interfere with my with ethical conduct or not? If not, okay, then we could certainly go ahead. Now, or at least we could consider moving one step further. Now, the commentator goes on and certainly speaks of sapaya sampajanya, namely clear comprehension of suitability, which then is basically your second test. And then not only do you check whether something is beneficial or not and is purposeful or not, but secondly also whether it's suitable or not. So to give a Dhamma talk to an audience of meditators or a group of meditators like you is beneficial and also is certainly suitable. But to give a Dhamma talk, let's say around midnight in one of the casinos in Las Vegas, what do you think? Will this be so suitable? Not really. And so, there are many such examples. And satna, the third clear comprehension is that clear comprehension of domain or territory, which means we have to check whether we're still in the territory of mindfulness or not, the territory of the four establishments of mindfulness. If we are still within this, then it's okay, then we're said to be within the proper territory. If, however, we are doing something but not really mindful of it, and maybe daydreaming or distracting ourselves, then we're outside of the proper territory. Yes, Sharmila?
Yeah, so at some stages, most of the stages of the practice, I guess, there seems to be a certain skewing of reality. I mean, we're seeing reality on one level, but at the same time, we can be hypersensitive or overreact to a lot of other things just as part of the practice. And when you take that into daily life, is that same thing going to be there? Like, you know, if you're more likely to be depressed, or are you more likely to be irritable if you're at one of those stages where that's one of the known effects of the stage?
So let me finish this first, and then I'll respond to your question. It's a good question. And so the fourth form of clear comprehension is that of asamoha sampajanya, which means clear comprehension of non-delusion, or, as Bhikkhu Bodhi has suggested, discernment of things in their true nature, free from delusion. And discernment of things or objects in their true nature, free from delusion, then is a form of wisdom. So knowing the nature of an object. So if you make, or if you subject all of your planned activities to the simple test of is the activity planned beneficial or not, and is there a purpose to it or a proper purpose to it or not, and then is it suitable or not, am I still within the domain or territory of the four establishments of mindfulness or not, if you have if you run your planned activity through those three, then the end result will be very good. So if something is not beneficial, then obviously you stop it right there. If some planned activity is beneficial, but it's not suitable, okay, sorry, then it stops with that. If something is beneficial and suitable, then you could go ahead, but you still need to make sure that you're within the realm of the four establishments of mindfulness. And so those in this context, the clear comprehension is very useful. So to pick up the earlier example and exaggerated example or illustration, right after the retreat to drive over to Las Vegas and hit the casinos there, then it might not even be beneficial. So that's for sure will not be beneficial, and thus we can then disregard that right away. Now, to answer Sharmila's practice, yes, indeed, in every insight knowledge, different things are happening. Different mental states tend to be predominant, a certain set or constellation of mental states, and this then will have an impact on our experiences on retreat, and also outside of retreat. And to share an experience from Lumbini. In the past, but not certainly anymore, our long-term meditators had to go to Kathmandu for visa extension, even though Lumbini is relatively close to the Indian border, and there's a border crossing south of Bairoa. Yet, the Department of Immigration would not let certain people do their extension at the border in Sonoli, but rather insisted that once the third month was over, that people had to go, even for the third month extension, third and fourth month extension, and fifth month extension had to be done in Kathmandu or Pokhara. And so the trip from Lumbini to Kathmandu is a long trip by bus. It's many hours, like 8 hours, sometimes like 16 hours, depending on landslides and whatnot. And the experience was that when a meditator, before going to Kathmandu for visa extension, was in one of those infamous dukkanyanas, then you can imagine what his or her trip was like, or experiences was like in Kathmandu. So the stay in Kathmandu, and then the person would go to the immigration office, get the visa extension done, and then immediately maybe spend a night in Kathmandu, and then the following day come back to Lumbini. And then when asking the meditator, well, how was your trip? Oh, terrible. And so, how was Kathmandu? Oh, terrible. I don't want to go there anymore. No. And then, if that same meditator or some other meditator would be more advanced in the practice and would be maybe, let's say, experiencing the knowledge of equanimity bond sattva formations before going to Kathmandu, then the person would take the bus and reach Kathmandu, go to the immigration office, get everything done, and come back and say, I had a wonderful trip to Kathmandu, everything went smoothly. Same activity, totally different experience. And this has happened not just once, not just twice, but many times like this.
Me personally, I've noticed the side effects before while practicing in daily life at certain stages. I definitely noticed that affected by interactions at work, and not in a good way usually.
Mm. Yeah, and it's good to know this, and this is part of the advice given in terms of mindfulness in daily life, to be aware of this. So what happens is, let's say, during an intensive one-month retreat, our practice takes off and we reach this level, whatever that might be. No? So then the retreat is over, you go back home, and you still have a good momentum going for maybe a couple of weeks. And then maybe you don't have the time to practice on a regular basis anymore, and you just get too busy, then gradually your level of insight will fade. It will weaken, it will drop off, and then you notice that your practice is not as good anymore as it was at the end of your retreat. And this then means you might be going through insight knowledges that you know already from your retreat, and they could be more on the pleasant side, more on the unpleasant side. And then sooner or later, your practice will stabilize somewhere. And so it depends on how far you got during your intensive retreat. So it may happen that your practice drops off close to zero.
And dukkha.
or that. And depending on which level of insight your practice stabilizes in, this will have a strong influence on your daily life. And so if, let's say, your practice ends up in this level of zero, then at times the hindrances might give you trouble again, and other difficulties might arise. Or in the dukkanyanas, in the infamous Dukkanyanas, it may happen that you notice, oh, overall I'm more on the sad side. No, so you see life in a somewhat more pessimistic way, in a more depressed way, or you feel somewhat more depressed. So there's no need to run to a doctor for this. Just be mindful of this and work with it in your meditation practice as much as you can. And actually, this kind of an experience, sometimes it could be even more intense. So the dukkha that is so obvious during daily life will or might serve as an impetus for you to do the next retreat, because you want to get out of the suffering, and then you'll be ready to sign up for the next retreat. And
is that not why too it's recommended not to make major decisions within month, say, afterwards, because of where you might be in the practice?
What's that to me?
Not to make major decisions close to coming out of a retreat. Wait for a while?
No. I've never heard about that. Like I said early on, if the mind, plenty of wholesome mental states are present in the mind, well, then take your decision, make your decision. No, but if the mind is rather negative and full of unwholesome mental states, then better not make a decision. However, if the practice is what is happening in terms of insight knowledge, the dukkha there is having a strong impact on your life, then you'll just have to deal with that and still make your decision. Those difficult states feeling a little bit down and whatnot, that's still practice related, and there's certain it's in association with insight knowledge.
But if you have equanimity coming out of a retreat and you make a decision, you can have a very different view of your practice.
So yeah, sure.
On what action you may be
going to. Yes, very much so.
Could you just explain one thing about the domain of action? How can I relate that to the... you're saying the... within a kind of an external situation where decision may be required, if I can relate to it through the four establishments of mindfulness. If it extends me beyond those four establishments, this I don't quite understand. How I can relate this external situation to these four establishments of mindfulness, so that it can assist me in making an appropriate decision. I was just trying to understand what you were driving at in respect to this question of domain of action.
Something is beneficial, something is also suitable, and you're mindful of what you're doing, then it's fine. But if you stop being mindful, and maybe you go get into drinking and whatnot, then you're not within the four or domain of the four establishments.
So if I can relate to the situation through one of the practices in one of the four foundations, then I can use that as a kind of test.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah. Okay.
No.
Thank you.
And maybe also, let's see, if something is beneficial, something is also suitable, and then you daydream in your activity. Then you're not within the four establishments anymore.
Self-retreat, do you recommend taking the eight precepts or just keep the five?
If you manage to, if you manage not to take the evening meal, well, then go for the 8 precepts. No, why not? But if, but let's say, for medical reasons or whatever other reasons you might have, if you prefer to be on 5 precepts, then just stay with the 5 precepts. Okay, now let's approach Jim's question of as a lay person, how to deal with daily life. And so how to live a spiritual life in a community as a lay person, life in the Dhamma, and so how to live in a culture that does not support this. Yes, is that correct, sir? Indeed?
Yes.
Okay, so there are many aspects to this question of yours, and you and Jennifer, you already are a community, a Dhamma community at home. Both of you are Vipassana practitioners.
Yeah, but you can't practice a bunker mentality, you know? You know what I mean by that, don't you?
Yeah, sure.
It's time to go out and get your helmet on.
So as far as I understand, the question is also how to relate. The question is friends, how to relate to old friends, new friends, Dhamma friends, not Dhamma friends, to relate to Dhamma friends, that's going to be easy, yes, relatively easy. And so for the non-Dhamma friends, well, you can still be polite to them.
I've already recounted how, you serve wine at dinner, you don't have it yourself. These dichotomies start opening up.
But I've given that answer already in the past, and you know it very well. The Venerable Sayadaw very much recommends that as Vipassana meditators, that we be courageous and brave to defend our precepts. And so even if your old friends don't understand, never mind, you put the bottle of wine on the table, okay, you guys help yourselves, and then you go for your orange juice. Never mind. Don't go for tradition. You can explain to your friends why you're not doing it, and they might sooner or later they might understand.
You can just say,
I can also be happy without any or without drinking wine.
That's less of an issue. I was going to raise the question of musawada, where, for instance, gossip, which is often a feature of, discourse with friends, and how to withdraw from that, without appearing offensive.
Well, you could choose topics, meaningful topics. Yeah. Rather than indulging in meaningless talk, before your dinner party or whatever, together with your friends, then think of some really nice topic that might be interesting to your friends as well as you and Jennifer, and then go for meaningful discussion. in Satya, then at the end of the evening, everyone might be delighted. Oh, what a wonderful evening. No, and it doesn't have to turn into musavada. No, not really. And I would say that in terms of proper verbal conduct, that's an ongoing training. No, it's ongoing practice, and so it doesn't mean that just because we take that fourth precept, then our verbal conduct is perfect right away. It's not going to be perfect, and there's so many situations where we could refine things more and more. I know it's an ongoing project.
I was going to say the sins of omission as well as of commission. Where you don't tell a lie, you just omit the truth. You know, you hold back from saying something and are not therefore, you know, perfectly honest in your discourse. I mean, isn't that also a form of musavada?
Well, the Buddha himself has used silence as a form of verbal conduct. You can always take that or choose that option, not to say anything.
To say that no solution. I'm not going to offer a solution, but just at the meditation center in Barrie at IMS, when I was a resident teacher there for staff for 4 years, and we have Dhamma program discussion on different topics every week, and even in a Buddhist live-in meditation center with a large staff who are dedicated to practice, there was a pretty thorough consensus. There is a pretty thorough consensus of opinion based in experience that right speech, quote unquote, is the most difficult practice in daily life.
Yeah.
And so it is considered to be a very powerful, very potentially transformative, and challenging ongoing practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But to make it a practice, to give it a lot of attention.
Every time I use harsh speech, I know it after the fact. Uh-huh. It's come out. It's too late, and I notice that it happened, uh-huh. And it really hurts.
Yeah.
It's not noticeable out there. It's noticeable only by myself.
Mm-hmm. But even the when you said you don't necessarily say everything, omit things.
Yeah.
There's a whole sutta on a speech and timely. What's timely to say when? Mm. It's not necessarily appropriate to blurt out everything right now.
Yeah.
There's a timely. It takes a growing refinement of sensitivity as to when to say what, when to be quiet, when to express something more fully, when to point out, when to admit, when, you know, all the different factors of speaking. And it really, honestly, in that community, and I would say probably in any thoughtful living Buddhist community, right speech is the most difficult practice.
Yeah.
And as a daily life, ongoing a community practice where people are not in silence all the time, they're in silence much of the time, actually.
Yeah.
So it's just more support to say it's a great practice.
Yeah.
It's a challenging
practice. Also to add to what Marcia said, you have to also see where the other person is at in terms of mental states. So if the other person is very angry, then you don't want to say something sensitive. don't know, something that might hurt, to hurt the other person. So you'd rather wait until, you know, the other person is in a mood to, that he or she can accept. Or is more willing to at least listen. Okay, now Jim, in terms of living in a spiritual community or spiritual life in a community, there's the principles of cordiality, six principles of cordiality from the Sāraṇīya Sutta, which also might be very useful. And so it's discourse number 48 in the Majjhima Nikaya, in Anguttara Nikaya, it's volume 6, Sutta number 12. And so, I'll just give you the discourse, and we won't have the time to go into all the details. There would be much to say about this. There are, meditators, the six principles of cordiality that create love or affection and respect and conduce to helpfulness or goodwill, as a different word, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. What six? Here, a person maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his certain fellow monks and nuns and fellow beings. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect, and conduces to helpfulness, non-dispute, concord, and to unity. Then the second quality is maintaining verbal acts of loving kindness. The third one is maintaining mental acts of loving kindness. Number four is, so basically it's metta, no? Metta in body, speech, and mind. And then number four, using things in common with one's certain virtuous fellow beings, and without making reservations. One shares with them any righteous gain that has been righteously obtained. And this too makes for love and respect, helpfulness, and so on. And so, then, as number five, the Buddha mentions, one dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with one's fellow beings virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblemished, unmottled, freeing, praised by the wise, and unadhered to, leading to concentration. And then this too leads to whole love and or affection and respect and so on. And the last one, the last point, is certainly that of wisdom, possessing in common wisdom that is noble and emancipating, and certainly that leads one who acts in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So this means in the end the wisdom of arahantship. So the higher the level of wisdom, the better it is. The less conflicts are there. Virtue has been mentioned as one quality. So three forms of metta, then sharing, dana, or chaga, liberality, and then virtue, sila, and wisdom. So dana, sila, panya. And the Venerable Sādhu Pandita has given a talk on the Sāraṇīya Dhammas many years ago on one occasion in England, and he made it very clear at the occasion that those six principles of cordiality are useful not only for one's own family but also for the community one is living in, and then for the, let's say, larger neighborhood, etc., etc. So those are qualities that are useful basically everywhere. And certainly they very much contribute to peace and certain harmony in the community. So that's certainly that. And then there are obviously many other things that make for a harmonious life. Let me see, just a second. Now, it's also good to know the things that contribute towards conflict, and among those, the Buddha has mentioned quite a number under the term of dispute, vivada, things that contribute to dispute. And here we have being angry and revengeful, being contemptuous and domineering, envious and avaricious, deceitful and fraudulent, having evil wishes and wrong view, adhering to one's own views and holding on to them tenaciously and relinquishing them with difficulty. And certainly, so basically, many of the unwholesome mental states. And we can say, probably safely say, that most of the unwholesome mental states are contributing to conflict in one way or another. No, and so, if you're interested in peaceful living in a community or in peaceful spiritual life in a community, then apply the Buddha's teachings as much as you can. Starting with practice of generosity towards others, and sila, and then mental development, so meditation practice, and then the brahmaviharas, and patience, and understanding cause and effect, and karma, and so on and so forth. There's so many, and right speech to highlight that.
Also add the famous cultivating spiritual.
And certainly, and a spiritual friend.
A very concerted effort at the point when you feel like you want more of a community of like-minded people to relate to, but you don't necessarily live in an organized community as such. To really consider that cultivation of spiritual friends. It's very, very, very. And how you do that? There's lots of ways you can do that, from a social level, on a practice level. It's the greatest treasure. In life, the cycle, the regular unfolding of life.
Also, with this, with your old friends, the impression I'm getting from meditators, but please correct me if this impression is wrong, that when one does meditation practice over a longer period of time, then some of the friends, some of one's old friends, that might turn out not to be not all that great anymore. And especially, let's say, if they don't have the ethical qualities, and maybe they're not interested in spiritual things, they're more interested in gossip and stuff like this. And so, usually, I know that people have had thoughts about this and saying, oh, I'm going to lose all my friends. But that's actually not the case. When you practice, you win so many new friends. And those are Dhamma friends, and those are friends who live in a very conscious manner, and to them the Dhamma matters a lot. And so then there will be very much very deep links with those Dhamma friends. And even if let's say some old friend or it becomes somewhat more difficult to relate to the person, well, then, don't throw the person out of your heart, who maintain equanimity towards the person. And if at a later point, this old friend of yours maybe comes around, also has had certain, or met with some dukkha in life, and then is prepared to maybe take the first few steps, and then you can give a helping hand. I don't know. So it's an ongoing process, and you'll just have to see how it goes. And, okay. Does this more or less cover your question?
My cup overflowing. Thank you.
Oh, it's overflowing. Oh, I see. And Chris was remarking today at the lunch table that especially with the old friends, no? Old friends, maybe the non-Dhamma friends. Well, we get together, so you won't be able to, or you will not want to engage in meaningless talk, in gossip. And so there would be other things to say, but it's already 8:30. So the mindfulness practice basically can be part of all aspects of our life, and it really remains or is up to our creativity to integrate it, and to be ready to explore new ways, and so then surely benefits will be there. So let me conclude today's Dhamma talk on mindfulness in daily life wishing that may you take the Dhamma practice or what you've learned during this retreat here, may you take this with you back to your homes, to your communities, to your families, communities, and friends and neighbors and so on. And then may the mindfulness practice be enriching to you and also to others. May it be for your well-being as well as for the well-being of others and for the well-being of all. And this is it for now.